Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
New York Senator Charles Schumer was in Plattsburgh recently to announce the town will be able to secure funding through the Lake Champlain Basin Program to fix deteriorating infrastructure on the former Plattsburgh Air Force Base. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley with more.
The former Air Force facility covered more than 3,400 acres. When it closed in 1995, ownership was transferred to the town of Plattsburgh. The water and sewer infrastructure was not upgraded before the ownership transfer, and some of it is beginning to collapse. Town of Plattsburgh Supervisor Chuck Kostick described the dilemma.
On June 20th, 2024, the Plattsburgh area suffered a weather microburst event with several inches of rain falling in a very short period of time. The rainfall was more than the 70-plus-year-old infrastructure could handle. Numerous sinkholes appeared, and several roads in the area had to be closed. Emergency repairs of those roads at the time approached $750,000. The challenges have not lessened since then, and please pardon the pun, they've actually deepened.
New York Senator Charles Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, was at the former base on Friday to look at some of the infrastructure that needs replacement.
The Cold War infrastructure that was here is falling apart, and now it's getting so bad that it's creating sinkholes on our streets and sending unwanted sentiments into beautiful Lake Champlain.
Schumer asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to assess the situation, and the Corps subsequently suggested approaching the Lake Champlain Basin Program.
The coordination led to the town's inclusion in the program's Watershed Assistance Program, and that's going to unlock new federal funding so we can clean this up without the taxpayers having to shell out more money. It's a great first step. Of course, we have to do more. So I'm here to launch my push to reauthorize the Lake Champlain Basin Program and secure increased funding for the former airbase.
Lake Champlain Basin Program Healthy Ecosystems Coordinator Meg Modley says they are concerned about water quality issues arising from the legacy infrastructure on the former base.
This is a significant water quality issue with the stormwater infrastructure running off from the old base into outfalls that go directly to Lake Champlain. So we are concerned about water quality issues related to this infrastructure.
Town of Plattsburgh senior planner Trevor Cole explained that the work area includes about 21 miles of the buried stormwater infrastructure built in the 1950s.
Everything that was constructed out here was built also to take stormwater from a massive flight line. For example, some of these pipes are built 20 feet underground and they're 72 inches. You know, you can practically drive a car through them. The town of Plattsburgh doesn't even own digging equipment that could go that deep, but that's the infrastructure we inherited.
Modley explained that the next step is to conduct a study of what's needed to fix the infrastructure.
We're really thrilled to move forward on studying this project and learning more about what we can do to reduce the amount of runoff coming into Lake Champlain. This is your drinking water source. This is where we recreate. This is where we fish and swim. And we're really looking forward to understanding better how much it might cost to remediate this problem.
Cole says the study is critical to understand the problems before they try to start fixing the infrastructure.
Some of it we know. It's obvious that we have crumbling old infrastructure. But to what scale and how we should fix it is the first phase. So it's a full assessment of the existing infrastructure, the condition that it's in, where it exists, because there are some unknowns. We inherited pretty good mapping from the military, but it's incomplete. So we need to understand where everything is, the condition it's in, and then the next phase would be working on the design for the modern appropriate replacement of that infrastructure.
The study is expected to take about 2 years to complete. Preliminary estimates based on current construction costs anticipates replacing the infrastructure will cost about $30 million.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The New York Public News Network's Sam Dingman sat down with the Albany Times Union's Sarah Trafton to discuss the state of police reform in New York.
After a Minneapolis police officer knelt on the neck of George Floyd for nearly 10 minutes, police departments around the country promised wide-ranging systemic reforms. 6 years later, in New York State, the results are mixed at best. Albany Times Union reporter Sarah Trafton recently took a deep dive into where things stand with the state's police reform initiatives, and Sarah joins us now. Sarah, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So if you could, Sarah, take us back to late spring, early summer of 2020, those early days after George Floyd was killed. What was happening by way of response here in upstate communities, and how did that reflect what was also happening all over the country?
There were a lot of emotionally charged protests happening in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. There was a lot of police responding to the protests dressed in riot gear, and that sometimes led to, you know, confrontations with civilians. So it was a very intense time.
Yeah. Another thing I remember from that time is this real sense of pressure on elected officials to have some sort of reaction to all of this, to make it clear that they were hearing what was happening in the streets as part of these protests. And here in New York State, then Governor Andrew Cuomo actually created some mandates around policing. Tell us what he specifically implemented at that time.
Yeah, he implemented a number of reforms at the state level. One example is banning chokeholds. He also established a special office within the Attorney General's office, the Office of Special Investigation. And that office is tasked with investigating civilian deaths by police.
Yeah. One of the things you reported on for this series was how things have been going with that office. Tell us what you found.
So since it was established in 2021, the Office of Special Investigation has reviewed nearly 1,400 cases. Of the 142 completed investigations, only 11 resulted in charges being filed. And of those, seven resulted in convictions. And what we found was that the threshold for prosecuting police in these cases is very high. In New York State law, you know, if you're afraid for your life, you know, a lot of times you can argue you acted in self-defense. If there's a way to safely get out of the situation, civilians have an obligation to do so. But law enforcement don't have that same obligation if they have reason to believe a crime has occurred. So it's very hard to disprove that, you know, that their actions were justified.
Gotcha. So if I'm hearing you right, the attempts to prosecute officers ran into the same obstacles in those proceedings as they would have in a regular civilian proceeding outside of the special investigations.
Yeah, essentially, they often don't end up prosecuting them because of just how high the legal standard is. You know, unless anything changes with that legal standard, they're still going to have a very hard time prosecuting these cases.
So one of the other things that former Governor Cuomo implemented at that time was the creation of these civilian review boards. And there have been some hiccups there, particularly here in Albany, where the board has struggled to retain members. What is the status of those boards more broadly?
So we looked at reform plans proposed in 173 places, and 24 of those places proposed some type of civilian review board. And what we found was that often these boards, they weren't actually formed. There was no legal requirement that they had to be formed. But basically, community stakeholders said they wanted them, but there was not really follow through in a lot of these cases.
Yeah. So another factor in all of this that came up at the time was the question of minority representation on police forces. George Floyd, of course, was a black man, hardly the first black man to be killed by police and spark wide-ranging protests where the police are accused of not representing the minority communities that they serve. Talk a little bit about how that piece of all this has unfolded, because in a lot of departments, there was a push to try to have the police forces be more diverse.
Yeah, so what we've seen in, you know, the past 5 or so years is that there have been modest increases statewide in Black, Hispanic, and female officers. Like Schenectady, from 2021 to 2024, they've tripled the number of women on their force. But when we analyzed that data against like population data, there are still significant gaps in representation.
So you were just sort of alluding to this in that answer, I think, Sarah, that there are some points of progress that have come up in your reporting. I realize a lot of this conversation is focused on things that have not really developed, I think, in the way that many people who advocate for police reform would have liked. But there are some signs that things are changing. Anything else that comes to mind for you along those lines?
I think while we did see generally an upward trend in use of force incidents, part of the reason that is because agencies are getting better at reporting it. So in a way, it is a positive that they're more accurately reporting use of force incidents.
Oh, right. So like even if the number of incidents is going up, we know that they're happening.
Yes.
What impressions did you come away with in terms of where the, at least in New York, debate about community policing stands? Do you think it is in a fundamentally different place now than it was in 2020 and 2021?
Yeah, I do think it's in a different place because there's less pressure. For most people, it's not top of mind as it was in 2020. For some agencies, you know, they're still moving in that direction regardless of whether there's a state mandate or not. But I think there's, you know, other places where that motivation might be needed. And for some places, their reform plans may have been more of, you know, an exercise to get done, to check their boxes. And, you know, I'm not sure that every place is going to be like revisiting this and seeing how far they've come.
That's the Albany Times Union Sarah Trafton speaking with the New York Public News Network's Sam Dingman. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli to talk about two new reports from his office that look at Lower Manhattan's revival 25 years after the terror attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001.
Our first report 25 years later, the transformation of Lower Manhattan. But parallel to that, we also released a report, a snapshot of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. Because when we talk about the economic development of Lower Manhattan, what has been done with the Memorial and Museum has been an important piece of that puzzle of economic development. But I think the main takeaway from the report is that when we think back to 25 years ago, a lot of folks just didn't think Lower Manhattan would ever come back again. And what we've seen is an incredible transformation, really speaks to the resilience of the community in Lower Manhattan, both the folks that stayed from those terrible days onward, the businesses that didn't give up on investment, the public sector investment as well, zoning changes, tax incentives, federal and state and city support, the nonprofits who very much have played a role in all of this. And what we've seen, just look at some of the indicators that we highlight in the report. The population over the past 25 years has doubled in Lower Manhattan. The economy has diversified. But when you think about Lower Manhattan, you think Wall Street, right? So you go back 25 years ago, about half the jobs were directly tied to the finance sector. Now the economy is diversified, so those finance jobs, still an important part of the economy, but now a third of the employment rather than a half. And you've seen growth in so many other business services, especially the tech sector, media, entertainment, leisure, hospitality. Lower Manhattan, in the old days, 5 o'clock, everybody left. Now, because you've had this great surge in population, many of the office buildings that were tied to Wall Street converted to apartments. Housing stock has more than doubled. It is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week community. Tremendous neighborhoods, really, financial district, and Tribeca is what we looked at, and an entertainment destination, restaurants, lively nightlife. And very interesting, you're seeing the creative class, a lot of the younger folks that are drawn to Manhattan. Lower Manhattan is a place that they want to be. So credit to those who were here and stayed. Credit to the new folks that have come in. But it really is quite a story of literally building up from the ashes. And it is a positive story about the resilience of Lower Manhattan, of New York City, of New York State, and really of America as well.
Yeah, the idea that you went from basically a kind of a business district that shut down, as you say, in the evenings to now a more vibrant, livable community, that kind of blows me away, because we'll remember at the time how many people fled the city after that attack.
Yeah, that's one of the aftershocks of a terrorist incident. It shatters your whole sense of security and reality. And when you think about the physical devastation, I remember I was in the assembly back then, and we took a tour shortly after the towers came down, before the pile was cleaned up. Just being down here, seeing the destruction, smelling it, even on Long Island, where I live, a day or two after, the smell just came over Long Island. And obviously the health concerns, which is number one in the news, as you know, right now.
Yeah, I was going to just ask you about that. What do you make of that?
Air quality and so, well, look, I mean,
that has an economic impact, doesn't it, when it comes
to
health?
And that was part of what you talked about with people leaving, right? Not really sure what the physical impact would be. But look, it's fair to say that many of the families and elected officials for a long time were asking for more transparency and disclosure on what was known about air quality and possible health impacts. And to find that some 60-odd boxes of files were suddenly come upon in an office, it's concerning. We'll see what comes of it, but I think you have to credit the current city administration and the current mayor for putting a priority on disclosing this information. That you need accountability. You can't have accountability without transparency. We all know that the after effects of 9/11 have had tremendous health impacts. You have many people come down with cancer and other debilitating health conditions. Many people have died, continuing to die. So the deaths are not just what happened on that day when the towers collapsed, but the ongoing death toll because of the health impacts. These are very serious issues. I want to mention one thing, though, David, because we're talking about what we remember. The other challenge is you have a lot of folks today that weren't even born. They don't have a memory of this.
Absolutely.
And that's why we did this parallel report on what the 9/11 Memorial and Museum is all about. Because one of the missions, besides honoring those who were lost, it really is about education and letting the next generation understand just what happened that day, how it did change our world in so many ways. And I had the chance to visit the museum. It's just an incredible museum, very powerful, and they're doing so much with school children to make sure they learn about this. And also, besides education, they play a role in advocacy, working very closely with the survivors, with the families of those who were lost. It is such a beautiful remembrance, but it has relevance to today as well. And last year alone, about 2.5 million visitors, and half of those international visitors. So this is part of what's drawing people to downtown Manhattan. So very important place of memory and respect, but also part of what makes this a very vibrant destination for people to want to be in Lower Manhattan, either as a visitor or living here.
That's New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Students are returning to school across New York this week, and on Tuesday, it was the first day of school in the Poughkeepsie Central School District. The New York Public News Network's Elias Guerra was there to ask families how the day went.
Outside of Sojourner Truth Elementary School, I spoke with Genesis, who's starting third grade.
It's so much fun at school because you go math, and when you grow up, you can go be one, like you could be a doctor of daycare and everything.
And her brother Pablo, who is starting second grade.
I like school because school's the best, and we gotta learn a lot because teachers are good at math and reading, and my name is Pablo.
The parents I spoke to, like Tatiana Garrett, were a little tired after a lengthy dismissal before 3 o'clock.
I can't with the dismissal. I cannot do it with the dismissal. They have to get something going with that. Other than that, everything is fine.
But said they were excited for the new year. The Poughkeepsie Central School District is undergoing several big changes this year. The superintendent, Gregory Mott, is leaving in February after the Board of Education voted to terminate him. As board president Jamar Cummings put it, the board is moving in a new direction. Cummings said the board is preparing to find a replacement for Superintendent Mott and hopes the search will be a community-led effort. There's also a new curriculum for students from kindergarten to 8th grade with the company Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, also called HMH. One goal for the new curriculum is for all schools in the district to follow the same program, which Erica Martin, whose son Dylan started kindergarten on Tuesday, said would be a great idea, especially to create stability for students who are disabled.
I think it's good. It's great. Because then if one child moved from one school to another, they, you know, with the teaching system, you know, they're able to just move along and it won't be a struggle.
While many parents were aware of the outgoing superintendent and new curriculum, many of them, like Martin, had another issue on their minds.
Technology took over a lot, especially with COVID, unfortunately, but we're moving forward as day by day, not year by year, day by day, but I think technology should be a no.
Garrett, whose daughter Gianni is starting first grade, said she's worried about AI and how it could hold children back.
I just feel like it's a cheat code. I don't know, maybe it could be, good for some things, but I feel like for kids to just help them use it in school, maybe they should be doing that by themselves, because back then we used to do everything by hand. So it's just like to expect a kid or just to be like, oh, hey, do AI, that's cheating. Because when it's a test, a big test, like Regents exams, what you gonna say, oh, let me use AI? So.
Martin and other parents emphasize the need for old school teaching with books and pens and papers.
The only technology that we need is for the children that are non-verbal. That's it. I think everything else, computers, laptops, no, they need to know how to write. They don't even teach, cursive now.
Diane Fernandez, who's from Ecuador, said technology can be helpful for families who don't speak English or didn't learn certain topics where they grew up.
Sí, estaría mejor porque nos ayudarían más a nosotros, más que somos de otro país, entonces sí estaría mejor porque es mejor para ellos que ellos puedan entender otros idiomas también y algunas otras cosas más que no hemos aprendido en nuestro país, ¿no?
The district's community schools approach aims to build bridges between school and home to better guarantee that children find success in and out of school.
I could play Play-Doh.
Play with the Play-Doh?
And I could tag anyone. And I could learn.
I love that. I love that.
And I could sing and dance.
Oh my God, so many activities.
And I could play too much later.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Well, the 2026 edition of the New York State Fair is now in the books. As Ellen Abbott with the New York Public News Network reports, despite a rare weather shutdown and new security protocol, officials called this year's fair a success.
For the first time in almost three decades, the fair closed its gates because of weather last Wednesday, and it showed Fair Director Julie Lefebvre that the emergency management plans in place for vendors were spot on.
We did it in a very orderly fashion. We actually gave them kind of a two-hour window of, like, this is when the parking lots will close, this is when the front gates will close, this is when the fair will close, this is when you can come in with your vehicle and grab anything you need to before the storm comes in. So I learned that all of the practice we do 12 months a year really paid off.
One area that did need some tweaks, the new policy prohibiting private vendor and exhibitor vehicles from entering inside the fairgrounds for most of the day. Lefebvre says, for example, an area fenced off for vendor storage proved to be a problem.
We realized that having it fenced in didn't logistically work to have it be restocked when whatever truck was coming in to restock it. So we ended up taking off one entire side of the fence, the entirety of the rest of the fair, to make it easier, because we realized that our own fence was creating, you know, an actual literal barrier.
Lefebvre says her office will now go over all the comments and complaints coming in from vendors and fairgoers about all aspects of the 13-day exhibition. They'll consider them going forward. For now, though, the end of the fair is a kind of letdown.
There's just boxes and there's empty tents behind. It's a ghost town, and it's definitely, it's a little sad.
At the New York State Fair in Syracuse, Ellen Abbott for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2637. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.